episode 518, Storytime with Michael, Paradise Lost, book 11.
Yeah. Almost done. As soon as you finish book 12, you'll have finished all of Paradise Lost.
Welcome to the Sci-Fi Christian, bringing you theology at warp speed. I'm Matt Anderson.
And I am Ben DiBono. We're back.
Back.
I bet you enjoyed these books because a little time travel action, and you're a time travel fan.
Yeah, big time. So let's just be upfront, everybody. We planned to record book 11's episode last week and did not.
Right.
So I have, as of this recording, read book 11 and book 12. I've completed Paradise Lost. Ben, do you want to congratulate
Congratulations.
Me?
Congratulations.
Can you believe it?
That's a biggie. So you've done Dante. You've done Paradise Lost. You're getting fairly well read.
Yeah, and we already agreed off the air that next year, the big classic we'll read together will be Don Quixote.
And maybe Beowulf.
And maybe Homer.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
Beowulf, I think you could...
That's
very easy.
Yeah, that's very easy. Yeah. So I also just want to be honest. I typically, when we're doing these episodes, I will read the book that we're on either the day before or even the day of the recording. So it's very fresh in my head.
It's not fresh in your head.
This one, book 11, will be not fresh in my head. And even book 12, I read it a few days ago just to make sure I had it done in time for tonight.
So these are going to be pretty rough.
So, you know, we don't want to fizzle out on this 12-week journey we've been on, or 12 episodes.
But we're going to trip at the
goal line. But I think we'll see. I want you to temper your expectations for these next two episodes.
I do see you gave it 5 stars on Goodreads.
Yeah, that's I'm afraid of Ben DiBono score. No, it deserves it. It's a classic. So books 11 and 12 are...
I think you're coming around to my point of view on this. There's some things you just have to give 5 stars.
I do agree with that.
Yeah.
I do agree.
Not 2001 or The Hobbit, apparently, but there are some things you just have to give 5 stars to.
So books 11 and 12 are Michael explaining to Adam the future. So as we mentioned in the last episode, Satan's gone. He doesn't appear anymore in this book, or in this poem, I should say. No more fallen angels, sin and death are not appearing anymore. Actually, they might be brought up in this conversation, but this is going to be looking ahead. Basically, it's Michael, the angel, giving hope to Adam that, yes, they have fallen. Yes, they are going to have to leave Eden, but there is hope ahead.
Right.
So I think we're going to be able to do these two episodes pretty quickly.
I think so.
Because it's basically just saying, remember that thing that happened in the Bible? Well, he talks about it here.
Right.
So here's how the book starts. Book 11 starts with God accepting the son's intercession for Adam and Eve, but still says they can't remain in Eden. So they send Michael down to go give them the good news. And he starts walking through history. So he talks about such things as Cain and Abel. Talks about, what else we got here? Enoch. And then this particular book wraps up with Noah. And Adam is somewhat comforted by the story of Noah in the sense that he survived, his family survives, and Adam then is happy to know, well, it's pretty good that somebody was saved and the world gets to continue on after us.
A little short-sighted there, Adam. I mean, Michael's basically telling you that 99% of humanity is going to die because you ate a piece of fruit. I don't think you have really anything here to hang your hat on, bud.
Oh, I forgot to mention one sort of interesting thing. Remember when it was Raphael the last time that was explaining things to Adam, and I don't know if he had
good cop, bad cop.
I can't remember if he had Eve leave or if she chose to leave, but she wasn't a part of that conversation.
Right.
This time, Michael puts her to sleep so she can't hear what
like
he
just sleep. It's not a euphemism.
Oh yeah,
like when you take your dog to the
yeah,
bed.
She's not dead. Right. Michael makes her fall asleep so that he can explain everything to Adam, so that Adam can be the one that tells her these things.
Right.
Do you have some thoughts on why it happened like
it's,
that?
It's going back to that, you know, we saw the divine order. We saw the divine order broken, and now we're seeing the divine order restored, though not quite perfectly, but it's that now we see Adam and Eve are preparing to try to live in the way that came naturally to them before, doesn't come naturally now, but you see the reassertion of the divine order here in these last two books.
I was just thinking about this. Tell me if you think this is true, and maybe this is just obvious, and I shouldn't even ask you, but do you feel like really the story completed with book 10, and books 11 and 12 are sort of the epilogue, sort of the wrap-up type thing, just to give it a sort of happy ending.
I mean, I guess you could say that. Then on the other hand, the poem is called Paradise Lost, and this is when paradise gets lost. Like, they're not kicked out of paradise yet.
I get what you're saying, but I feel like paradise was lost at the fall, even right. though they technically hadn't exited Eden yet.
Right, yeah. But I don't know. I mean, a little bit, but epic poetry's kind of weird that way. Like, where, I mean, the Iliad's kind of the same way, where, you know, Achilles kills Hector. I'm sorry, but it is like 10,000 years
what?
Old.
I was just going to read that.
Yeah. And there's a big whoop-de-doo. And then the last book is just funeral games for Hector and Patroclus.
I mean, in some ways, don't you feel like and Milton so, could... Yeah. Oh, sorry. Do you want to keep
saying I'm just saying that it's kind of the same type of thing where that's just kind of the structure of these epic poems where they don't necessarily... It's not trying to go out with a major bang. It's like we have our major bang and then we kind of wrap things up.
I was going to say that it kind of felt like Milton could have just tacked on a quick conclusion at the end, but... All right, he does his 12-book thing. That's fine.
Well, I think it's important to him, though. I think that what happens in here is important to Milton's theology. It's important to the way that he views the story. You know, it's what makes it uniquely Christian, that he does look forward to redemption. And I do think there are some really fascinating things in here going on theologically. Okay. And in terms of how we maybe getting us to look at the story of Adam and Eve from a different perspective. For example, kind of going back to what we were just talking about. Well, yeah, paradise gets lost when they sin. And we just know that they're getting kicked out of the garden. We just know that. But Adam and Eve don't know that at this point in the story. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of those moments that to me is very jarring in terms of how Milton forces us to reconsider the story from different views. That when you pick up the Bible and you read Genesis 3, Adam and Eve getting kicked out of the garden is just a given. It doesn't surprise you. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hit you in any way. It just flows naturally. But by putting us in the psychology of Adam and Eve in this moment and realizing they think they're staying put, and then Michael comes down to give them the old toodaloo, and like that completely changes the way you think about that element. Another thing to think about in here is that in Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve, the idea of what is death has been a very vague concept in their minds mm-hmm. up until now. They don't understand what that means. And for Adam, he actually sees somebody die in this vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he
and it's his son.
And it's his son. Which, by the way, if Michael comes down and gives you a vision of one of your kids killing each other, you might want to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, like maybe do some sort of warning or just don't let them play together.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, then Adam.
So
just
that,
like,
now that's on Adam.
Yeah, 50 years later, okay, go get Abel.
Bring oh, wait.
Like really bad parenting.
Yeah.
A bit of an oversight there. But anyway, it's very significant that...
That he sees death.
Yeah. And that this is the first time any human has experienced death. And I think that's another detail that Milton draws out and puts you in the mindset of Adam and Eve in a way that is very difficult to grasp just reading the biblical story.
All right. Quick quote here from my study notes. Milton's stated purpose in the poem is to justify God's ways to man. By the end of book 10, Milton has been able to explain his concept of what God did and why, but he has offered little in the way of justification. Do you believe that's true?
For what God does? Yeah. I don't think he thinks he needs to justify God.
That's how I take it, too. Like I said, this is from my study notes. So to me, I don't feel like, well, God doesn't need to make a justification for his actions in real life or in the poem.
Yeah. Milton's theology is kind of weird, or a little bit of a weird mishmash, as I think we've seen along the way. And even in this book, you know, right in line 3, we have this reference to prevenient grace, which is, you know, right away signals to us that Milton's heavily in the Arminian camp of the Arminian Calvinist debate. But then the whole emphasis on God's sovereignty, his that kind of God doesn't owe you any answers really does kind of have a Calvinist tinge to it that I think you see less in Armenian theology traditionally. Not to say that they're incompatible, just that's traditionally Calvinists emphasized that more than Armenians did do. And so it's kind of interesting that Milton is taking a little bit from here and a little bit from there as he's constructing his theology of God.
This note goes on to say that even though up until Book 10 it hadn't given God's justification, that this vision for Adam is supposed to be a sort of justification because it shows Adam, here's what you did. Adam, you really need to understand this. Here's why it was wrong. Here's what the consequences are, not just for you, not just for Eve, but for all mankind. And then it also ultimately shows why these consequences end up being better than what would have happened if Adam and Eve had just remained sinless in the first place, because we get the whole Jesus storyline coming up in Book 12.
Yes.
So, yeah, and so I think do you feel like that is what Milton's doing? That's the justification?
I think it is. I think that, and really that is kind of the case I think Christian theology as a whole makes for the problem of evil, is that the answer to the problem of evil from a biblical perspective is the biblical narrative, or from a Christian perspective is the biblical narrative. Mm-hmm. The idea that God brings something greater out of sin is that's obviously there could be a lot more to it that we would want to say if we were formally stating this theology. But when you get right down to it, that is the Christian justification for the problem of evil, is that God brings something greater as a result of this sin, and that doesn't justify the sin, but it does allow for the problem. That's, you know, why would an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good God allow for the existence of evil? That's the answer.
I only have one note left, so I'll let you take it from here.
Okay.
Unless you don't have any notes that you want to discuss.
There's not too much more I want to discuss in this one, no.
All right. Well, I've been looking, as I've been reading these study notes, looking out for times that Dante comes up, because we did Dante last year. You're a big fan.
Yeah.
Is there some overlap? So here is a note on that. For the most part, Michael's description of history has been what most critics call degenerative history, showing the steady decline of mankind. This view of the world is similar to the classical myth of the four ages of man, in which mankind goes from a golden age, a paradise, through deteriorating stages of silver, bronze, and the present iron, in which ultimate paradise, in which ultimate collapse seems imminent. In the Inferno, Dante had presented this myth in the image of a statue with a golden head, silver shoulders and chest, bronze torso, and iron legs. Dante added clay feet to symbolize the corruption of the church. Paradise Lost and biblical history follow the same pattern to a point. They both begin with paradise and Eden and show successive stages of degeneration until God destroys the world by flood.
I agree. And of course, that image in Dante originally comes from the book of Daniel, or is adapted from the book of Daniel. Yeah.
All right. So I knew this was going to be a short one.
Do you want a fun little note?
I do.
I have a fun note.
Yeah.
Fun facts, I think you call them.
All right.
So there, I'll read this little section, and there's a word here that will jump out to us. So this is talking about the flood, and this is in line 829 for those playing along at home. Then shall this mount of paradise by might of waves be moved out of his place, pushed by the horned flood, with all his verdure spoiled and trees adrift, down the great river to the opening gulf, and there take root an island salt and bare, the haunt of seals and orcs.
Whoa,
little Tolkien action here.
How did that happen?
So this is kind of interesting because orcs in this case means sea creature, kind of like the modern orca whale for all of us Free Willy fans out there. But what's interesting in terms of that there is probably a relationship here to Tolkien, at least etymologically. So the word orc is, the root of this goes back to Orcus, who is the Roman god of the underworld. And then terms that are prefixed with orc appear often in Old English, including in Beowulf. When we read that, we'll see them. And so Milton's use of orcs, the orca Free Willy, and Tolkien's orcs all go etymologically back to the same root.
Interesting.
So if somebody ever asks you, What do Free Willy and the Lord of the Rings have in common? You're ready with that answer.
That is a fun fact. Yeah. Thank you. I have a question for you. I forgot to ask this earlier.
Okay.
So during the prophecy, not the prophecy, during the vision, they, especially in Book 11, they may mention a person that we know is Noah, but they don't say that. Instead, we get a line like this, 8:76, "For one man found so perfect and so just that God vouchsafes to raise another world from him and all his anger to forget. But say, what mean those..." I'll stop there. So the point I wanted to make there is it says, "For one man." It doesn't say, "For a guy named Noah." So in this book, and some in Book 12, when giving the vision, it leaves the names out, but then other times it's very specific, David, or, you know,
yeah,
things like that. So any thoughts on why he chose to name some and not others?
Well, it could just be technical reasons. You're writing to meter when you're writing poetry.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
nothing rhymes with Noah.
Well, it's blank verse, yeah. So nothing rhymes.
Yeah, that's true.
But you got to get your...
Well, sometimes it rhymes a little bit. Like the line I really like from Book 12, "So he dies, but soon revives."
Yeah, that doesn't rhyme.
Kind of sounds the same.
It's
kind of got a feeling of rhymingness.
A little bit, but that you, dies and rives are not rhymes.
Is even that kind of... You get what I'm saying. It kind of has a feeling of rhyminess.
This is iambic pentameter, blank verse, so there's got to be 10 syllables in each line. So, "An olive leaf he brings, Pacific sign," 10 syllables in each line. So, Noah has 2 syllables.
It would've...
"For one man" has 3 syllables, so...
What can he have just said? "For Noah."
He could.
That's great.
I don't know. I don't know. That's just a thought.
All right, everybody. Well, if you like this episode,
I
just
guess
wait.
You could have done that.
Just wait for Book 12.
Theory.
Yeah, well, that's all from here. I'm Matt Anderson.
I could just read the whole book in that just so everybody gets the idea. I'm Vandy Bono.
We're the Sci-Fi Christians signing off, about to conclude this in the next episode, Book 12.
Yeah. Book 12. Goodbye.
Ben, go load up onedayswages.org/thesci-fi-christian.
I saw that people are taking pity on us.
Wow. Everybody, thank you. This has been a great week.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed because I really wanted, like, I'm fine with people donating, but I wanted to set the record for the longest donation gap, and we didn't get there.
Yeah, so let's see here. I'm gonna list a bunch of people, even if we maybe mentioned you in the past, everybody, but Seth... Let's start with Seth. He left us 2 donations this week. Thank you, Seth. He had some items he was selling online, so he mentioned that. Well, let me just read this real quick. He says, "Hi, Matt and Ben. I'm finally starting to sell off some of my ridiculous DC memorabilia hoard, and the proceeds are going here and to other charities. More to come, assuming more things sell." And then, let's see how many days later. 2 days later, he dropped another amount of money here. So thank you very much, Seth. That was great.
He said it was a Batman v Superman item, and I'm looking at the dollar amount and trying to wrap my mind around that somebody paid that much for a Batman v Superman.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Bob wrote in, well, and donated and said, "Thanks, guys, for the podcast. Really love the discussions about things like Dante and other classics, or the talks about Catholic theology. I'm very much Protestant, but Ben's thoughts have at least helped me understand a little better why Catholics believe what they do. Well, I don't always agree with Ben's loathing of certain elements of popular entertainment. I always enjoy the discussions. Great podcast, and it's a great thing you are doing with One Day's Wages."
So we're almost halfway to our annual goal.
Oh, this is
great. So if we can get to 2,500 by the end of the month, we'll only have 2,500 more to do for
exactly.
December.
It's easy peasy.
Exactly.
Thank you.
He's still counting on those end-of-the-year donations.
Also, I want to thank Dan, who gave us a donation. Kevin says,
already said them.
"Love the show. Blessings to you all."
We already thanked them.
You sure?
Yeah.
All right, well.
I know we did.
Here we go. I said I wasn't positive who we already covered, so I just want to cover our bases. So thank you to everybody that's been donating. Right now, go to onedayswages.org/thesci-fi-christian. We're raising money for a water fund, which brings water to places around the world that don't have access to clean water. So go to onedayswages.org/thesci-fi-christian.
That last part kind of goes without saying, don't you think? It's like if this was a charity that brought water to places that do have access to clean water,
that would be a really bad charity.
Really worthless charity. Like, they're just walking around downtown Minneapolis handing out water to people's sinks.
That's weird. Meanwhile, we also have our poll open right now on thescifichristian.com. It's called The Sci-Fi Christian End of the Year Jubilee Official Ballot 2016. So just go there. It's a simple clicking survey where you can vote on such things as episode of the year, countdown of the year, movie review episode of the year, book of the year, book review episode of the year.
Yeah.
So tons of things to vote on. We want to thank our selection committee who helped us make this awesome ballot. Ben, you had some thoughts?
And unlike some other ballots you might have filled out recently, we have great choices.
Thank you.
We have great choices.
Yeah, exactly. So go to thescifichristian.com. It's right on our main page. It's the end of the year Jubilee official ballot. Go fill it out. All right. That's all from here.
Yeah. Ben, goodbye.
So long, folks.
Yeah.